playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. So what did the minister say to the Pope? That was the question Miriam O'Callaghan asked Catherine Zappone when she came into the Today studio on Monday.
I said to the Pope, Benvenuta Papa Francesco, io sono responsabile per la tua mother and baby home.
After she read out everything she said to Pope Francis during her brief exchange with him in Italian at Dublin Castle last Saturday, Miriam inquired if the Minister for Children had written the speech herself.
Oh, yes, I did write it, Miriam, because again, as we just said, I knew that I just had a few, 30 seconds, okay? And I suppose, really, as a professional, I knew I wanted to get a very straight message. And in order to do that, and also I'm just beginning learning Italian, but I knew enough to want to communicate to him in his own language. And so, yes, I practiced it quite a bit the day before.
And when you were speaking to him and you said this to him in Italian, what did he say back? Is it true he responded to you in English?
Yes. He leaned towards me and he looked directly into my eyes and he said, thank you for saying that. In English, just that. I was deeply appreciative that he responded that way. But I want to say, too, that when I was speaking and I said, io sono responsabile per la tua mother and baby home, immediately a clear sense of recognition crossed his face in relation to Chum. As I said, then he thanked me. Of course, then, as you referred to, later in Dublin Castle, we were listening to what he said, and then he referred to my words still echoed in his heart, which, well, I was blown away by it, frankly, you know, that he would refer to it, that it impacted him. And then again, actually yesterday morning, I spoke with President Higgins, who said to me that when he had his conversation with the Pope after the welcoming, that he spoke to him in Spanish. The two of them spoke in Spanish and covered a lot of very, very important topics. And at one stage, then the Pope said to him that he was most grateful for the direct way in which I communicated to him and that it gave him a greater understanding of the anger and the hurt and the sorrow of those who had suffered.
Before she left the studio, Miriam also asked Catherine Zappone a slightly more personal question.
You personally, I'm conscious of your former wife, Anne-Louise Gilligan, who left this earth not that long ago. What did it mean for you personally when you reflect on the visit?
Well, in preparing to do, you know, as I said, I think a very significant thing in my ministry in speaking to the Pope and delivering that message, I really felt so deeply Anne-Louise's presence within me. And then having done that and just walking by myself, leaving Dublin Castle, it was one of the first times, Miriam, that I really felt the depth of her presence surrounding me. Because, of course, she spent so much time with me in Dublin Castle in relation to other great matters. But I really felt it in a different way that day.
Minister for Children, Catherine Zappone, talking to Miriam O'Callaghan on the Today Show on Monday. And returning to the subject of the papal visit.
Oh, he's marvellous, marvellous. He's a great man. And we were thrilled to see him. And he's going to do great good now, here and now. Yeah.
And he went around twice in the Pope mobile.
Fantastic. And we went through a barrier here, which you shouldn't have done. It was just so emotional. It's fantastic.
Yes. You hopped over the barrier.
Oh, well, not quite. We went through it.
What is the world coming to? People breaking through barriers to get close to the Pope. That's from Theresa Mannion's report from the shrine at Knock, as heard on This Week last Sunday. The next big event for Pope Francis on Sunday was, of course, the Phoenix Park. Amongst those to don waterproofs and wellies to brave the elements on the day was Morning Ireland reporter Louise Byrne, who joined a group from Bonnybrook in North Dublin as they gathered in the early hours of the morning in their local church car park.
Are we mad? Nuts!
The mood is a little dampened by the wet conditions.
Our family are saying we're mad, but they know what we're like.
What have you got
nothing,
with you?
Nothing, but we have on our
what we're standing up in. You've got your chairs, though.
Oh, we have our chairs.
We have them.
Yeah.
But 32 parishioners, including Margaret and Teresa, have their rain gear on, their bags packed, and their fold-away chairs at the ready.
Okay, so here's the plan. You all have a ticket. Most of you have an orange band. that your ticket and your band gives us the access into the Chapel Izzard Gate.
On the specially arranged coach, Father Joe Jones explains the day ahead.
So, anybody any questions before we get off the bus? How long is it going to last for? We should be home by Thursday.
He's joking, we think. As we drive to the coach park designated for private buses, some of those on board explained their decision to come to the Papal Mass.
Anne Rahman, and I'm from Coolock. As I said, I'm looking forward to this. This is going to be a great day.
What have you brought with you? How have you prepared?
Well, see this? That's a Pope's chair, cardboard, wrapped up in a plastic bag. I have my lunch with me. My prayer book and my rosary beads, and that's the principal thing.
When you heard the Pope was coming, were you always going to be going to this Mass?
At all times, yes. I was at the last one, so I said I'd hand me around for the next one.
When you peeked out the curtains morning, did you think?
It tested me faith, all right. Oh, thank God, you know what I mean? We're going for a long walk here.
Once parked, some singing to get ready for the long walk ahead.
I hear music in the air, over my head. I hear music in the air. There must be a God somewhere.
Yay! And so, after a sing-song, a long walk and a picnic-style lunch, the Bonnybrook parishioners spotted the Popemobile doing its rounds, and like the two ladies in Knock, once they got a glimpse of Pope Francis, there was no stopping them.
We ran, we just hopped up and flew around, and we got right on top of him, right beside him. He looks much younger looking in reality, you know, than on the telly. He was waving to us all, and very pleasant, isn't he?
So you left your corral to go and get a closer look.
And care about our stools, and he just ran.
From Louise Burns' report on Monday's Morning Ireland. Although, as you'll have heard, lots of people did turn out to see the Pope and were delighted to have done so, the issue of the Vatican's handling of clerical abuse cast a long shadow over the papal visit. Joe Duffy and a panel of contributors provided the commentary on the Mass at the Phoenix Park on Radio 1 on Sunday. One of those panellists was Dubliner Rachel Hegarty, who wrote a poem over the course of last weekend which encapsulated much of the anger that many people feel about the way the church has acted.
When you first came to Dublin way back in 1980, there were hidden Catholic cruelties aplenty. Our Lady was weeping on the watch, untying the knots, while Irish babies were stolen from lone mothers' cots. Every city had cruel laundries on the main roads or streets, with Magdalene slaves washing out stains from manky sheets. Worst of all, on this island, some clerics tortured and raped our kids, while priests and bishops wrecked lives and kept down lids. But look, Pope Francis, this is Ireland 2018. The non-believers and faithful turned that nightmare into the dream. Irish women now control our bodies and make choices. Clerical abuse survivors howl for justice and use their voices. We have families headed by lone parents or with two mothers. We've got gender fluid kids, LGBT grandparents, and lots of others. We are making real the new things we want for our old church. Come on, Francis. Come with us, or you might be left in the lurch. So enjoy the dear accents of the North Inner City and Mayo with its landscape so bleak yet pretty. Take a selfie with a proud Irish traveller girl. Listen to our Taoiseach give fighting words a whirl. Sign a GAA t-shirt and enjoy the tango dancers in Croke Park. But remember, the Irish are here for a sacred light out of this dark. The church needs to catch up with its own people, justice seeking and strong. Francis, two Irish August days, reminding you truth and justice are Christ's love song.
Rachel Hegarty, as heard on Radio 1's coverage of the Papal Mass at the Phoenix Park last Sunday. Another big event in Dublin, which will see the crowds coming out in their droves to Croke Park tomorrow, is of course the All-Ireland Football Final. I had planned on playing you some footage of diehard fans from both counties getting behind their teams, but in the course of listening to All-Ireland-related items on the radio on Thursday and Friday, I couldn't help but be struck by two men from both counties who began talking about football but ended up talking about their late wives. Former Dublin footballer Charlie Redmond was Ray Darcy's guest in studio on Thursday. Ray asked Charlie how he first met his wife, Grainne.
I actually met her thanks to Dublin Fire Brigade. She was a student midwife in the Rotunda Hospital, and I was sent in there on my training for paramedic to witness some births. And as ironic as it is, the first birth we saw was a woman called Redmond.
Right.
And she thought I was the husband. Now, she didn't know me from football. She did,
right.
She thought she wouldn't, or even though her father was a big footballer, she didn't know me at all. So when I asked her out for a drink, she was looking at me a bit bemused, because the true wife not just have a child over here, you know.
Yeah, cheeky.
So as I said, I always said I'd always met across the crowd of the umbilical cord.
And you, three daughters.
Three daughters, yeah. Sarah, Ciara and Ruth. Sarah is in Amsterdam presently. She's studying her master's in law. Ciara is entering her final year of social studies in Maynooth. And my youngest daughter, Ruth, has recently just got her Leaving Cert results, and she's going down to Maynooth to start in a couple of months' time.
That must have been... So Ruth was 16 at the time, was she?
Ruth would have been 16, died. Yeah.
That's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah, it was tough for everyone at the time, you know. We knew straight off from 2013 the gravity situation. We were told our life's changing in a matter of 2 weeks. We were on holiday and we came back and she wasn't well on holiday, and we went into the doctor, we got a scan, and I knew straight away when the doctors didn't come back to us, who quickly they were sending me off to another hospital. I knew we were in trouble, and we got up to the Beaumont Hospital, and David Hickey, a friend of ours, former Dublin footballer, and indeed a man who knew Grainne from her work in Beaumont Hospital, he sorted us out very quickly. And on the 19th of August, which was Grainne's birthday, she had a forced operation to remove part of her brain, because it was she had a 5 centimetre brain tumour. And 2 days later, we got the terrible news.
Charlie Redmond talking to Ray Darcy on Thursday. On Friday's Morning Ireland, in his report from County Tyrone, one of the people Tommy Gorman spoke to was Kevin Skelton, whose wife Mina was killed in the OMA bombing. As they sat in the Peace Park in OMA, Kevin began by talking to Tommy about his connections with the GAA.
My brother played for Tyrone in the 86 All-Ireland final. He played in 3 All-Ireland and lost the 3 in vocational, minor and senior. And I was a referee myself for 20 odd years up until 1998, the wife was killed.
Nobody better than yourself knows the huge connection there is between the GAA and the people here in Tyrone.
Well, the time of Mina's funeral, waking funeral, the amount of people that came to the house, GAA people from right across the breadth of Ireland, the GAA to me, and always has been to me, and we had our difference of opinions about things, but it's like a big family. This Sunday has knit the community around here even tighter together, and that's all sections of the community. You know, I've heard other people from different religions, they're still chatting about Tyrone, and it's like at the end of the day it's just a game, but it brings people together, and that's what it's all about. And I think with the Cormac McAnallan and all the tragedies that have happened over the years in the Tyrone panel itself, never mind now this is the 20th anniversary of the OMA bomb, and I think maybe with a wee bit of divine intervention, a wee bit of luck, we can pull it off on Sunday.
Kevin Skelton talking to Tommy Gorman, as heard on Friday's Morning Ireland. Another bombing in Northern Ireland which is remembered on air this week was the one at Mullaghmore in 1979, the year Pope John Paul II visited Ireland, in which Lord Louis Mountbatten, his grandson Nicholas, Nicholas's paternal grandmother Dorothy Braeburn and local boy Paul Maxwell all died. On Monday's Liveline, we heard from some of the first responders who were at the scene. On Tuesday's programme, Joe spoke to Paul's mother Mary, who recalls here how the day unfolded.
That morning, Paul had gone off
he was going up to the castle where he would have breakfast, and then he would go down on the boat with Lord Mountbatten. And Paul just said, "Goodbye, Mum." And I said, "Goodbye." Mm-hmm. And I never, ever saw him again. My husband and myself and one of my daughters were on the patio at the back of our little cottage mm-hmm. when we heard this enormous bang. My first reaction was, I said, "Paul is dead." My husband said, "Don't be so silly." Mm-hmm. I said, "No, it's Paul. He is dead." So my husband, he went down to the harbour to see what was happening.
Yeah.
And he came back and he said, "Yes, Paul is dead."
Later in the interview, Jo asked Mary how often she has visited Mullaghmore since Paul's death.
I suppose about 3 weeks after the awful tragedy,
mm-hmm.
I went back to Mullaghmore and I went round to the cliffs where the tragedy had happened, and I took some red roses and I flung them in the sea and I said, "Goodbye, Mullaghmore. I will never, ever come here again." But I did.
Mm-hmm.
In, I think it was May of 2015, Prince Charles visited Mullaghmore for the first time.
Yeah.
And I was invited to meet him and also to go to a service of remembrance and reconciliation. And I went to that.
By the way, is the holiday home still there, Mary?
The holiday home is still there.
Yeah.
But it is now derelict and unfortunately it's going to be sold.
Okay.
I find that very hard because Paul's last days were in that little cottage, and that is just a little bit hard for me.
Yeah. And do your daughters, Lisa and Donna, do they go back to Mullaghmore?
They go back every single summer. They go back, and they are both very, very good swimmers.
Mm-hmm.
And they both go round to the very place where the tragedy occurred, and they go and they swim there because they say that it makes them feel very close to their brother.
From Tuesday's Liveline, another mother who lost a child as a result of the IRA bombing campaign was heard on The Tuberty Show on Thursday. Wendy Parry's son Tim was killed in Warrington in 1993. She told Ryan how she first heard news of the bombing.
Colin and I had gone over to my parents, and then it was when we got back home, all the neighbours were out on the street and they asked us where the children were, and we were like, "What's happened?" Because we didn't have the radio on. And they said about the bomb in Warrington. So I immediately then tried to find the children. Abby was actually on a bus going into town, and the bus was stopped, so she ended up walking home with her friends, but we found Abby. Dominic was at home, and then it was trying to find Tim when we found out that Pierce, who was with us, was in hospital. We then went to the hospital trying to find him. Tim was looked 16, even though he was only 12 and a half. So they kept saying to us, "We haven't got a 12 and a half year old boy here." So we just assumed from that he was okay, but we had to find him. And then a priest asked us if, basically, what was he wearing? And when we told him, they said, "Oh, come in. Can you come into this room?" And we knew then that it was Tim.
Did that priest have an envelope with him?
No. When we were in the room, the surgeon then came into the room and he poured out Tim's. He had a St. Christopher round his neck and a watch, and he poured those out on the table and said, "Are these Tim's?" And we said yes. And he said then, "I'm really sorry to tell you that I've been working on Tim for a while. And I really don't think he's going to live the night, but I need to get back to him. And that was it then. We were just basically left in a room with a nurse in the room as well. But we were just stunned. We just sat there in silence. We just didn't know what to say, what to do. So it was a real strange feeling to be told your son may not last the night.
Wendy Parry talking to Ryan Tuberty on Thursday, and the Parry story is featured in a new BBC drama, Mother's Day, which is due to be broadcast tomorrow night.
Thank you, Holy Father. Welcome to Dublin, the greatest city in the world.
That's Damien Richardson speaking on stage at the Croke Park Meeting Families event on Saturday. Damien and his wife Mary have 9 children themselves, and they're also foster parents to a 10th child. Both have battled heroin addiction in the past. At this point in the interview, Damien tells Ray about how his faith helped him to overcome his addiction.
I went to my doctor, I did, and he was very good. I went in every day and he was giving me methadone, he gave me a few painkillers, but for myself, I had this determination. I either wanted to die or come off the drugs. Something had to give. You know, I just couldn't be like this, taking drugs, you know. Like, you know, I lost a lot of my pals through suicide, through ODs, through different things and that, you know, through violence and that. And something had to give. I couldn't keep this despair, this hopelessness anymore, you know.
And then was it over to Knock for you, Damien?
Yeah, that's what it was. I went down to Knock to the Chinaglo community, and it was tough. The first month was tough down there, you know, a lot of paranoia and stuff. But the lads were very good to me, you know. They showed me a lot of love down there, a lot of compassion, you know. And slowly, I was there for the first month, and I said, this place is working. I could see get me strength back in, a bit of hope back in my life, you know.
How about you, Mary? How did you eventually kick the habit?
Well, as I said, when Damien went into community, for the couple of months after he went in, I was still going to my doctor, taking the methadone and the tablets, and I would have been drinking as well at the same time. Would have been on a lot of stuff, you know what I mean? So while he went in, I decided I need to do something with myself, get myself clean. So I went into one of the HSC centres in Ballyferma, and that's where I got myself clean from.
That worked there for you. What were their children around at that stage?
We just had one of our daughters, which was Tammy at the time. She would have been 3 at the time. And that's another reason why I wanted to kick it, because she was starting school and I didn't want to be going to the school gate and everyone saying, oh, look at that mother there, look at her on drugs or whatever, you know. So I wanted to be clean and to be able to bring Tammy to school and just be a good mother and be a better mother, you know. And that's why I kicked her.
Mary and Damien Richardson talking to Ray Darcy on Tuesday. Another mother who was on air this week talking about the challenge of being a good parent in the face of adversity was a Cork woman who featured in Brian O'Connell's report on mental health services for children on the Today Show on Wednesday. Here she describes an incident in which her 11-year-old son, who has been diagnosed with ADHD and has in the past been on medication, had what she describes as a psychotic episode.
He lost all control of himself. He ran into traffic. He got very angry when he was trying to concentrate in school, and he got so frustrated he started lashing out, hitting, kicking, and we were advised to try and proceed and take him to A&E. So we didn't tell him where we were going, we told him I had to go to A&E.
How long ago was this?
Only a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we proceeded to get him to A&E. And once he got to A&E and realised it was for him, he absolutely screeched, kicked off inside A&E. And about 8 to 10 staff members had to surround him to try and get him through A&E. And it was extremely distressing to watch him. He was literally out of his mind in panic. Dad, help me, Mama, help me, make a stop, make a stop. And I proceeded with his teacher to try and walk him through the A&E, and all these people staring at us and looking at him, and he's out of control. Can she control him? What type of a mother is she? And eventually we got into a quiet room in the bottom of the A&E, and they tried to give him medicine and he wouldn't swallow it. And then they said to me they'd have to hold him down to inject him. And we waited for about 8 hours for CAMS team member to arrive, and after he arrived he stated that this was a local CAMS issue and there was nothing he could do for us, that my son needed his medicine adjusted, and we were discharged after 8 hours with no help whatsoever. And we waited quite a number of weeks for this appointment to come through. So I laugh when somebody says take a child to A&E. I felt a failure as a mother. I felt I was the worst mother possible, that here I was with an out-of-control child and everybody looking at me thinking, what way did she raise that child? If I had a magic wand, I would have tried to change him.
From Brian O'Connell's report on the Today Show on Wednesday. One of the most poignant interviews on air this week was Miriam O'Callaghan's conversation with Tess and Danny Valdez, whose daughter Justine was abducted and murdered by Mark Hennessy in May. This was the first interview the couple has given, and with the help of a translator, at this point in the interview, they remember that awful day when their only child was taken from them.
I'm keeping crying, I don't know what I'm doing.
We couldn't stop crying. We couldn't eat. We just didn't know what to do, and we couldn't believe what had happened.
When did the Gardaí tell you that it was Mark Hennessy, who obviously had been shot dead by the Gardaí, that it was him who had murdered your daughter, Tess?
Lunes na yata yun, nung talagang inano na nila.
It was on Monday when we were informed by the Gardaí that Mark Hennessy was the one who murdered Justine. We were informed on Monday at 10 in the morning.
Did it ease your pain at all that Mark Hennessy, who murdered your daughter, was subsequently killed himself? And of course, that shooting is still the subject of an ongoing GSOC investigation.
Oo, talagang nasaktan ako kasi bakit niya nagawa sa anak ko yun.
Nagustuhan niyo ba yung napinatay siya?
Hindi.
We didn't like that he was killed. It didn't change anything. When we found out that he was killed, it didn't ease the pain at all. It didn't matter. Justine was gone. We are also sad that he passed away. So, nagtaka din kayo kung
bakit pinatay
niya.
So,
mababal loob niyo. We felt bad that he was killed straight away, quite quickly, because we wanted to find out what was running in his head. We wanted to know more about why, because there are a lot of questions in our minds, and we wanted to know more about why he had to do such a terrible thing.
Did you get to say goodbye to Justine?
We weren't able to say goodbye. She was still asleep when we left the house. We didn't want to wake her up. So our last conversation, so to speak, was a message, just a text message that day, but they weren't able to say a proper goodbye.
You are both Catholic. You have faith. Did that help you at all deal with this terrible tragedy?
Nakakatulong naman. Palagi kami nagdadasal. Pero mayroon ding question na bakit kami napabayaan.
It really hurt us because we also question God. Because why is it that when we needed him the most to protect our child or to help our child, he wasn't there? So, yes, we prayed so hard, but we also are hurting because we feel that we were left in pain.
Some weeks after her death, Tess and Danny found a letter which Justine had written to them. Here's some of what she wrote.
To my mom and dad, I don't know how to express the words I love you right from the bottom of my heart, because words aren't enough to let you know how much I love and care for you. It's hard for me to express, but I hope this simple letter of mine is really appreciated, and I just want you to know that those words attached here is real. I really mean it. I'm so lucky that I have you as a part of my life. Because of you, I have overcome all the trials in my life. Without you, my life now would be a mess. You're always here to guide, protect, and give all what I want.
Tess and Danny Valdez, as heard on the Today Show on Wednesday. Gareth O'Callaghan is a familiar name to Irish radio listeners. He's had a long and illustrious career as a broadcaster. But sadly, Gareth has recently been diagnosed with a condition known as multiple system atrophy, which has prompted him to retire from his broadcasting job on 4FM. He was a guest on The Tubridy Show on Tuesday. Here he tells Ryan how he felt after he received his diagnosis.
You're left in a room on your own, sitting on the side of the bed in your dressing gown, on a Friday evening when all of your mates are going for a pint, and I should be giving traffic news on the radio 6:10. And I'm kind of looking out the window of the Mater Hospital thinking, I have this awful disease. And it's incurable. It's very progressive. And I'm going to have to try and figure this one out here.
Is your illness, it sounds kind of like it belongs almost to the motor neuron disease family in the sense that will you end up in a wheelchair, will you end up on a stick or a Zimmer frame or, you know.
Yeah, ultimately that's what happens. So yes, that's not a possibility. It is what lies out there. But you can't wait for that. You really do have to keep going. And it's very, very difficult. There's mornings when you wake up because I'm permanently feeling it now. I feel like I have a kind of a flu a lot of the time. I'm taking different medications to soften a lot of the symptoms that are there. The blood pressure issues mean that it's so easy to get dizzy and fall. Mm. Some people with it can faint, which is very dangerous because obviously you injure yourself. The line of progression is pretty similar for most people. I think you end up using a walking cane. Mm. Yes, you will end up in a wheelchair. Yes, you will end up confined to bed. And, you know, all of the systems that are being impaired become more and more impaired as you go along.
As somebody with a happy disposition, Gareth, and we were roaring laughing because your imitations of both Mike Murphy and Gay Byrne are unparalleled. But that's for another day. So, you know, that's and now we go serious because your illness is serious.
Yeah.
Do you find that the happy Gareth and the sick Gareth are fighting with each other? And is it a battle for one to win over the other, the positive and, if you like, the negative? Who's winning?
I like to think that, you know, and I do, like, after a drink or two, and I'll just break into something. It could be a song or, you know, I could turn around to somebody and say, don't you know? And immediately people say, it's Gay. Gay's come into the room, you know. And I say, hello there, everybody. How are you? Hello, Ryan. And then, of course, there's Mike Murphy. I was actually talking to Mike the other day. Hello, Mike. And the endorphins kind of bubble up inside you. And you feel better. But there are very dark moments, unfortunately. Very, very dark moments.
Gareth O'Callaghan in conversation with Ryan Tubridy on Tuesday. Pantysocracy describes itself as a cabaret of conversation hosted by Ireland's most talkative drag queen, Panty Bliss. This week's show brought together a panel of guests who have all stood up for something they believe in. One of those guests was Saoirse Long, who came to public attention in the run-up to the recent referendum when she posted a video in which she spoke about having had an abortion.
I had gone through what a lot of women have gone through in this country, an abortion. I kept it to myself because you couldn't speak about it. We're a Catholic country. It wasn't acceptable. So when I went through that experience, after I'd come home, I dealt with all that fear and anxiety alone because it wasn't even in my head to talk about it. Yeah. I couldn't say it to friends and stuff because it just wasn't the norm to talk about it. So I'm seeing posters, I'm seeing pictures, I'm hearing campaigns and I'm watching every single day TV, horrible things being said. I was hooked on it, really. My boyfriend's here in the audience, he knew nothing. And it was the night the Late Late Show decided to talk about it. I think we were going to go for a walk. And he said, come on, let's go for a walk. And I was like, I need to watch this. And he was like, we can watch it when you get back. Like, you know, it's fine. And I was like, and then I started bawling crying. And I was like, I have been through this. I thought he was going to break up with me. I thought, I'm horrible. I'm a devil. I'm everything wrong in a person. So he was amazing. And from then I said, okay, I want to tell my story. And I just kind of thought, right, I'm not ashamed anymore. This happened to me. I was denied proper healthcare in my own country. And that was as simple as it was. It's time to speak up.
So tell people who don't know what you actually did then.
So I rang up a director friend of mine. I said, look, I have a story to tell. Can you film it? I went over to his apartment. He had set up the whole thing. He said, look, I'm going to press record on the camera, I will leave the room and I will edit the start and the end of it. So I went there and it was the first time that I spoke about it. It was the first time that I relived that story. Mm. And even I can't watch that back without crying because it's so real. So I'm sitting in my house and I'm going, every day I was like, I will, no I won't, I will, I won't. Yeah. And I thought, okay, I have to do it. So one morning I got up really early and I just uploaded and I paced the kitchen up and down and I was dreading what was to come. And honestly, I got probably about 99% positive feedback from it.
Did the reaction to it then make you feel like you had some sort of responsibility after that? Or
hugely. So I was inundated with messages. Mm. I counted 600 plus, I think 620 women contacted me who have been in my situation. I've had teachers contact me, friends. Like, I've had people reach out to me that I would never in a million years have thought had gone through this and have hidden it away from their kids, from their family, because they're ashamed. And I made sure that I wrote back to every single person, which is probably crazy. Every single person that wrote to me, I just felt, I can't believe the support I'm getting. And it meant the world to me.
Saoirse Long, as heard on Pantisocracy last Wednesday. Adrian Childs is a well-known British television presenter. He made a documentary which aired recently on BBC called Drinkers Like Me, and he was a guest on The Ray D'Arcy Show on Wednesday.
My kind of drinking is just mundane. Yeah. You know, I don't drink during the day. I don't get drunk. I have a couple of pints with my mates, you know, and then he might be dragging me out to go for a later drink and I resist it and I go home relatively early. Didn't drink a lot at one time, but drank often. Drinkers like me would watch the kind of programmes I'm talking about what Frank Skinner would call perno in the morning type drinkers. We'd look at that and we'd say, oh, that's not me, I'm fine. The first day of filming, the scales fell from my eyes. Now, for me, it was quite a heavy day, admittedly, right? So West Brom were playing Liverpool and it was a lunchtime kickoff. And I had 4 pints of Guinness in the pub beforehand. Now, that's a lot at 11 o'clock in the morning. Yes, yeah. That's not my normal thing, okay. But it's by no means unheard of on a match day, right? OK, and then I didn't drink all afternoon. And then I went to my mate's 40th birthday. I had a couple of beers. I had, you know, a few glasses of wine, another beer. You know, I never felt drunk at any stage, and I was tucked up in bed by sort of 1 o'clock. Then they came around to film me at my flat on the Sunday morning, and I went through it on this app, and it was 34 units of alcohol in one day. I thought, you know, God, I must be in triple figures over a week. I'm in the middle of the documentary. I went to see this liver specialist, and I was quite confident I was all right, actually, because not long before I'd had a load of blood tests at my GP, and he said, oh, your liver function's fine. But the actual scan of the liver wasn't fine. He says he got, you know, light to moderate fibrosis. And, you know, that was the second big shock, genuine shock in making the thing. But wow, you know, have I? And then actually the third big shock has been the last week when actually seeing it in print said, why don't we drink 100 units?
Yeah.
Who does? Oh, me. It's me they're talking about. It was like an out-of-body experience. You know, a petrol tanker went past me on the motorway while we were making this film, and I thought, I wonder if everything I'll drink would fill that. Yeah, and I did the rough sums, and it basically did. I've got another image in my mind. If I lined up all the drinks I had in my life, it's almost 3 miles long, that line of drinks.
Adrian Childs talking to Ray D'Arcy on Wednesday. Comedian PJ Gallagher was a guest in the Arena Studio on Thursday. Himself and playwright Una McKevitt have written a play called Madhouse, which is to have its debut during the upcoming Dublin Fringe Festival. The play is based on PJ's own experiences growing up in a house in which his mother looked after people with mental health difficulties. Although, as he told Sean Rocks, the play is very much written in the kind of language which was used in the 1980s in Dublin.
For me, that's different, though. I would use the word mad in a different way, because that's my memory of it. I grew up in the 80s. Nobody ever said mental health. There was no such thing. You didn't have bad mental health. You were the poor fella that had trouble with his nerves, or you were somebody that was, you know, he's lost his mind altogether, you know. And the part of this, what I like about this is, the family, our family, are as mad as the people we're supposed to be looking after. So there's essentially 10 people in the play. There's our family and there's the mad people. And I would have always, growing up, I always used the word mad. And I definitely use it for us and for them. It's just 6 of them people in this play have certificates of authenticity, whereas our family don't. So it's kind of like, what is mad and what isn't mad?
Yeah.
And this is a mad house. This whole environment is ridiculous. Who does this? Who lives like this? Nobody does.
Did it feel mad to you at the time? Or did it feel like, well, this is our house, so therefore it's quite normal, quite ordinary, quite usual?
No, it felt usual, but I just thought the world was bloody mad.
The world was like this.
So, like, there's one part we did in an old show, and it's made it into this as well, where, like, and a word I would have used a lot was mentlers then, which you'd never use now.
Yeah.
You'd never use it. And I remember going to other people's houses and thinking, it's just our family. Like, where's everybody else? Where's everyone else? Like, this is...
So this like, was a quite ordinary... Run of the mill setup for you.
But at the same time, I knew it was mad. Like, I knew it was affecting everybody. Everybody in the house was affected by it, you know. But I'd be like, you know, go and get your mad people because it's going to get dark and you'll never get, you know, you had this just weird existence.
I was going to say, PJ, did you have much of a relationship with the men who were lodging in the house?
Probably not. But then did I have a huge relationship with my family? Probably not. You know, so there's a lot of it about the play that focuses about just being out all the time, you know, just being out and about, just out exploring the world because the house is too busy. Like it's less busy outside. There's more peace outside, you know. You get more attention from your friends than you do inside the house because everybody's so wrapped up in what needs to be done, you know. Like when your mother has to literally like hand out, I don't know, like 145 pills a day to six people, and you're walking around looking for chips, it's probably better to go out. So do you have the best relationship with your family? No, not really. Did I get to know my sister after all of this? Yeah, probably didn't know her at all until this.
PJ Gallagher talking to Sean Rocks on Arena on Thursday. That's about my lot for this week and indeed for the moment. Marion Richardson is back in this chair next Saturday. To play us out, here's Brona Gallagher, who is a guest in the Today Show on Wednesday. This is Stranger. I hope you've enjoyed my selection on playback over the past 4 weeks. So until the next time, goodbye.
Heard the great romance is over, what you talking about? I pretend I didn't hear what you said. Always overstep the line I drew in my blood. Remember, love, you left me for dead.